Recent military expansionism, which ignited the Ukraine conflict, has disrupted global food supply and worsened the food crisis for African countries. These U.S.-led NATO countries have spent billions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine while ignoring appeals by UN agencies for emergency funds to alleviate the suffering of tens of millions in need of urgent food aid. Sudan is one of the countries facing inadequate international response to the drought situation.
The response of the international community is not enough. Of course, there was alert from the international organization dealing with food security, dealing with health. But these alerts finished with only alerting, and there was no quick response from international community, international relief organizations. And before all, there was no good response from the government.
Sudan's Minister of Trade and Supply, Amal Saleh Saad, recently called for agricultural investments in the country and for the exploitation of the vast Sudanese agricultural lands, adding that the country could serve as a food basket for other countries in the region. Now, Sudan is a country blessed with abundant water resources and fertile soils and was once referred to as Africa's emerging bread basket. So what really went wrong?
That is true that Sudan has a lot of water resources, a very fertilized land, and a very hardworking people, farmers. And this could be a good assist for Sudan to be one of the leaders in Africa, if not in the whole world, in providing food and food security for its citizens and for Africa. But the problem is a bad governance. The problem is political before all. Sudan has lacked security, has lacked stability for the last, 33 years. After the toppling of Bashir, we did not have stable government. We have for 2 years, a mixed government of civilian and military, but also it was a very weak government. Now we have a military government which is faced by a very strong opposition from young people, from political parties. And in this situation, you can't manage the country in a good way.
Now, so what measures can be taken to restore Sudan's glory as an agricultural country capable of meeting its needs and exporting food to other African countries?
The first step is to settle the political crisis and to build a stable government, with some kind of popular support and political support, because the military alone could not rule the country, and they have big challenges to maintain stability and security. The second measure is to allocate money for investing in agriculture sector, and before all, to provide very quick support to farmers in order to supply the market with food products and with agriculture products. Also, there should be a good supporting policies for agriculture in the country, and concentrating on transforming the agriculture from traditional agriculture to industrial agriculture.
Well, democratically elected government and massive investment in agriculture are critical if Sudan is to use its potential as Africa's breadbasket. That's the opinion of our guest today, Adil Abdel Achi, the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. I'd like to thank him for his incisive analysis today. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It was great having you watch the show today. Please let us know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media. And goodbye for now.
Hey. His cradle is empty, his body is bloody, his body is bloody. His cradle is empty, his body is bloody, his body is bloody. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. His cradle is empty, his body is bloody, his body is bloody. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. My face is colored by the blood of my son, by the blood of my son. My face is colored by the blood of my son, by the blood of my son. I saw him in a huge fire kindled inside me. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. I saw him in a huge fire kindled inside me. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. I lost him here, but I lost him, but here's my honor. I lost him, but here's my honor. Though an infant, a great hero. Though an infant, a great hero. He supported his father when he was surrounded by much sorrow. He supported his father when he was surrounded by much sorrow. Old tent dwellers are now in a big grief, now in a big grief. Old tent dwellers are now in a big grief, now in a big grief. Tents are burning of both my sides and fire of enemy. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Tents are burning of both my sides and fire of enemy. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty.
What you just heard was a lamentation for Chief of Martyrs Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, performed at Tehran University Mosque by members of the Saradlah Group of Mourners of Tehran University Medical School.
In the Limelight.
What is happening today in Masafer Yatar is just as fundamentally a part of this phenomena as the ongoing repression and resistance in Sheikh Jarrah in Gaza and beyond, says Omar Zahza, member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, in an article published under the heading Masafer Yatar Evictions Enabled by British-born Judge. Stay tuned for more. To Palestinians and their supporters, it is known as Masafer Yata. To the fake regime of Israel, and in keeping with the aseptic detachment common to colonial regimes, it has been firing zone 918 since 1981, when then Agriculture Minister Ariel Sharon decided on that designation explicitly in order to force out the area's residents. Located in South Al-Khalil Hills, the area spans 12 Palestinian villages with nearly 2,800 residents whose livelihoods depend mainly on farming. Agricultural communities have lived on the 8,600 acres of land and called it home for generations. In 1999, the Zionist regime's army expelled 700 residents of the area, though they were able to return pending a final ruling. This decades-old attempt at ethnic cleansing is now entering a crucial phase. On May 4th, the Zionist regime's High Court issued a ruling enabling the expulsion of nearly 1,200 Palestinians from the area, including 500 children, a decision the UN said may amount to a war crime. On June 1st, the Zionist regime forces demolished two homes in Khirbet al-Fakhit and two storage sheds, as well as two homes in Khirbet Markaz, both part of Masafer Yata. In all, 21 people, including 9 minors, were displaced. 11 homes and workshops have been demolished since May ruling. Masafer Yata puts on full naked display the cynical, oppressive, and overall colonial character of the ruling issued by David Mentz, a judge who lives in an illegal settlement in the West Bank, and the Zionist regime's actions. In the words of Nidal Yunus, head of the Masafer Yata Village Council, the ruling was simply racist. The court decision is a racist decision taken by a settler judge. We have been fighting with Israel in the courts for the last 22 years, and it took this judge 5 minutes to destroy the lives of 12 villages and the people who are dependent on the land, unquote. Yunus regards the ruling as a continuation of the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Yunus has said, "History repeats itself, Nakba after Nakba." This helped throw into focus how a major injustice has become entrenched. British-born Mentz wields total life divesting power over those who are indigenous to the land. Through and through, the Zionist regime weaponizes interminency, an unresolved preponderance of settlers and settlements, really, colonizers and colonies, undeclared borders, de facto annexation against the indigenous population. The Zionist regime's main imperative is to displace no matter the cost. This is why the families of Masafer Yata need to prove that their home is their home, and why this ostensibly simple, even mundane truth can be so arrogantly delegitimized by the labyrinthine logics of settler colonial law. Yunus' words also capture in exacting detail how the struggle of Palestinians in Masafer Yata illuminates the overall anti-colonial character of the Palestinian resistance struggle as a whole, Nakba after Nakba. So long as Zionism, The Zionist regime's ideology exists, it will continue to mean an alternating dance between colonial violence and the reactionary settler laws that justify it. And of course, there is the settler, the glorified squatter, the would-be colonizer fully supported and enabled by the fake regime of Israel, which in turn was founded by and is sustained through the very acts of violent theft, appropriation and racist dehumanization of this figure represents. What began as an apparent exception is inevitably codified into general policy by a settler colonial regime. Organizers and activists remain acutely aware that there is an added layer of cruelty in addition to the colonial process of expulsion from Masafer Yatah. As activist Hamdan Muhammad Al-Horeini has explained, it's not really about destroying the houses, it's about destroying the life. If the area can be entirely depopulated, the time during which Palestinians lived there can in turn be erased. This allows the Zionist regime's colonial repurposing to eventually be confirmed by a surface reality made possible by ethnic cleansing. Then there will be no sense of time, no possibility of history outside of the colonizer's claims. Indeed, to be Palestinian living in the extended present of ongoing Zionist settler colonialism means confronting time on many levels and in many ways. First, naturally, it means to continue finding oneself racing against time, as the Zionist regime and its military steal more land, prolong an inhuman blockade, raise more homes, and continue to execute, detain, and incarcerate Palestinians, fracturing intimate timelines of kith and kin. It also means to have colonial history weaponized against you as procedures and conventions set into place by a violent settler regime become their own repetitive reference points, justifying Palestinian dehumanization and dispossession. The ongoing struggle to save Masafer Yatah encompasses all of this. But the story of Masafer Yatah is not just the greater story of Palestinian dispossession. It is also the greater narrative of Palestinian resistance. The entire regime of Israel can't remove me. We will not leave. We will not get out of here because we are the inhabitants of the land, Palestinian farmer Khaled Al-Jabarin has declared. The phrase Nakba after Nakba reminds us the Nakba was not a moment in time. It is an ongoing process, a process against which Palestinians continue to rise up. This is a phenomenon as the ongoing repression and resistance in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah, in Gaza and beyond. The Unity Intifada of 2021 showed the world that Palestinians are rising up together regardless of location. This is why we must not only support the call to save Masafer Yatah in as many ways as possible, we must also see the fight to save Masafer Yatah as connected to the larger battle for defeating the Zionist settler colonialism and to free Palestine from the river to the sea. Aperture.
At the height of the Cold War,
The CIA launches a highly classified, top secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont-Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades, the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Albarelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake.
Hank Albarelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps, notably horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946 in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined.
Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? Do you think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made, and if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't, and so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, And Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont-Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont-Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont-Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did. And in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont-Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself. These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug.
On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. That's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. The last thing I would like to recommend is for you to follow up on the files you open and to finish them. Finish the various cases involving public affairs that the judiciary has started. For example, about some factories, some illegal seizures, and the like. You shouldn't open a wound and then not finish it up. Of course, there is usually a big commotion in the beginning when something like this is being done. Then it is slowly forgotten. Whatever you start, whatever issue it is, he mentioned central issues are very good. Especially pursue these because of their priority. Finish the matter and complete the cases. Then you can move aside. Your work is hard, truly hard. Indeed, the work of the judiciary is one of the jobs that is very difficult. I have been in the ongoing executive affairs of the revolution since the beginning of the revolution. I have always said that I am afraid of accepting to be in charge of matters related to the judiciary branch, and I have avoided doing so because this is a very difficult job and it is very demanding.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You have taken on much work on yourselves. Well, the reward for this is just as much. That is, in proportion to the amount of the work that is done, the divine reward that is given is also just as much, insha'Allah. Follow up on the work that is being done for the sake of God. Follow up on work while benefiting from divine guidance. God willing, insha'Allah, you will be given the divine reward. You may do a good action at times and no one realizes it, not even your manager or your boss. your subordinates may not understand what you have done either. For example, you may have worked a few hours over time, or maybe you did a job carefully, or perhaps you fought diligently with corruption and dishonesty. No one may realize what you have done, but the scribes of God realize. Furthermore, the Almighty God is present and watching over all of this himself. God willing, your reward is with Allah. I hope that God the Almighty will make the pure soul of the great Imam Khomeini happy and unite the pure souls of the martyrs with the friends of God. May God unite the soul of dear Shaheed Beheshti with the friends of God, God willing, inshallah, and may he bless us all with a good end to our lives. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's legal team is in direct communication with Justice Department officials. The first sign of talks between the two sides as the criminal probe into January 6, 2021 accelerates, sources familiar with the matter have told CNN. The talks revolve around whether Donald Trump would be able to shield conversations he had while he was president from federal investigators. The article you're about to hear has been written by CNN journalists Caitlin Pollance, Kara Scannell, Gabby Orr, and Kirsten Holmes. The article has been published by CNN and is titled Trump Lawyers in Talks with Justice Department about January 6 Criminal Probe. Former President Donald Trump's legal team is in direct communication with Justice Department officials. The first sign of talks between the two sides as the criminal probe into January 6, 2021 accelerates, sources familiar with the matter have told CNN. The talks revolve around whether Donald Trump would be able to shield conversations he had while he was president from federal investigators. In recent weeks, investigators have moved aggressively into Trump's orbit, subpoenaing top former White House officials, focusing on efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election, and executing searches of lawyers who sought to aid those efforts. The Trump team's discussions are with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., which is in charge of the investigation, and its top January 6 prosecutor, Thomas Wyndham. The sources said. The conversations have not been previously reported. At this stage, the conversations are focused mostly on whether any communications that witnesses from the Trump West Wing had with the former president can be kept from a federal criminal grand jury under Trump's claims of executive privilege, the people said. The Justice Department has been anticipating a court fight with Donald Trump over executive privilege. The issue has arisen as grand jury subpoenas have been issued to two former White House counsels, office officials, and to former Vice President Mike Pence's chief counsel and chief of staff. Donald Trump's legal defense team has warned him that indictments are possible, sources have told CNN. Some members of Donald Trump's legal team have discussed his potential defense strategies on at least two occasions in recent months, according to two sources familiar with the matter, as they brace for new developments in the Justice Department probe and a separate investigation by Georgia officials into his potentially criminal meddling in the state's 2020 election results. Rolling Stone previously reported that Donald Trump has been briefed. Trump has grilled his attorneys on whether they actually believe he will face formal charges, according to sources. Yet the former president has expressed a heavy dose of skepticism that he will be indicted, one of the sources familiar with the matter has said. Another source close to the former president told CNN that Donald Trump also has posed questions about a potential indictment to members of his inner circle, some of whom believe the president is concerned about the possibility of federal charges. But one person close to Donald Trump said he is noticeably more engaged when he's chatting with friends and advisors about the 2022 midterm elections and his possible presidential campaign in 2024, that he has been during briefings on legal strategy. This person described the former president as dismissive in conversations about his legal troubles, often repeating his witch hunt mantra as he claims the various probes he's facing are plainly driven by political opponents. A Trump spokesperson said in a statement to CNN, "There is clearly a concerted effort to undermine the vital, constitutionally rooted executive and attorney-client privileges through partisan political persecution. How can any future president ever have private conversations with his attorneys, with his counselors and other senior advisors if any such advisor is forced, either during or after the presidency, in front of an unselect committee or other entity, and be forced to reveal those privileged, confidential discussions?" The spokesman said. President Trump will not be deterred by witch hunts or kangaroo courts from continuing to defend and fight for America, our Constitution, and the truth. The U.S. Justice Department has so far declined to comment. In recent months, the former president has ignored advice from some of his advisors to avoid speaking with former and current aides who have become entangled in the House Select Committee's probe into January 6 and may become part of the criminal investigation, people familiar with the matter have told CNN. Donald Trump has specifically been counseled to cut contact with his former White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, whose actions leading up to and on the day of the U.S. Capitol insurrection have been deeply scrutinized by the House panel, the people said. Two of Mark Meadows' former top aides, Cassidy Hutchinson and Alyssa Farrick Griffin, also have been highly critical of Donald Trump, with Cassidy Hutchinson testifying about damaging details about Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021. During her public testimony before the House panel in June. Hutchinson is cooperating in the Department of Justice probe as well. Some of Donald Trump's attorneys believe that Mark Meadows could also be in investigators' crosshairs and are concerned he could become a fact witness if he's pushed to cooperate in the Justice Department probe, according to two people familiar with the matter. In response, Meadows' attorney, George Terwilliger, told CNN on Thursday, "All of that is idle and uninformed speculation, apparently by people that know little but talk a lot." Former White House attorney Ty Cobb said Mark Meadows is perfectly positioned to be the John Dean of this mess, referring to the former Richard Nixon aide who offered crucial public testimony during the Watergate hearings. The reason Mark Meadows is valuable is also the reason he is in jeopardy. He was basically at Trump's right hand throughout all these exercises and participated in key meetings and phone calls, Ty Cobb said. Yet, according to a source familiar with the relationship, Donald Trump and Mark Meadows have spoken a number of times. Another source close to Trump described their relationship as not the same as it once was while they served in the White House, but insisted they still maintained the relationship, even as Trump has complained about Meadows in his recent conversations with other allies. Mark Meadows has been known to attend fundraisers and events at the former president's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, where he also helped organize a donor retreat last April for the Conservative Partnership Institute, a group he runs with former Republican Senator Jim DeMint. The securing of Trump's endorsement for U.S. Senate candidate Ted Budd was the last time that Mark Meadows was really around regularly. Since then, he's never been a big part of the political operation or Donald Trump's thought process, said a second person close to Donald Trump.
Imam Bagher, peace be upon him, said, "Pilgrimage of the tomb of the Messenger of God and the martyrs, and pilgrimage of Imam Hussein's tomb, equals to an accepted Hajj that has been performed in the company of the Messenger of God."
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Israeli regime has sealed its crossings with the Gaza Strip since Tuesday, further exacerbating the humanitarian situation in the impoverished territory. Currently, there are two Israeli-controlled crossings into the tiny coastal territory, the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, and the Erez pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza. The crossings have been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007.
The Israel closure of the crossings for the third day has serious, severe implications on the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. We are calling on the international community for immediate actions to pressure Israel to lift the blockade in Gaza.
The impoverished coastal territory already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Most Gazans also depend on handouts from international aid agencies to survive.
Closing the crossing point from the Israeli occupation, it's a collective punishment. It's part of blackmail against Palestinian people. Over 2 million people living in Gaza, they are living in the huge jail. The social and economic situation so deteriorated.
For 15 years, the Israeli regime has kept an illegal and inhumane closure on the Gaza Strip, affecting the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians and restricting their freedom of movement.
Gaza crisis, due to the Israeli continuous blockade for 15 years, suffering from serious implications on the economy, on the humanitarian conditions, the employment, food insecurity, poverty increased to unprecedented percentages.
Tel Aviv's move to shut down the crossings will further complicate living conditions in the impoverished territory. According to human rights groups, the Israeli blockade has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and worsened its humanitarian conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.